Hello, everybody. My name is Daniel Prince, and I am the host of the Once Bitten podcast. This is a podcast focused on Bitcoin. It's my mission to interview as many people as I can around the different aspects of Bitcoin and help people understand exactly what Bitcoin could mean for them and for their families and for their future. I hope you enjoy the show. Thank you so much for listening. Hey guys, welcome to this edition of the Once Bitten podcast. And joining me today is Jonathan Kirkwood, a professional physician, hospitalist, doctor, whatever you want to call it, all of the above apply, turned Bitcoin fund manager. So he's left his fiat job behind him and started 1031 with his cousin, now has the likes of Parker Lewis, Marty Bent, and Matt O'Dell, to name just three huge names in the space, helping them on the front. So I hope you enjoy this one with Jonathan. Thank you for coming on and sharing everything that you shared. Now, before we do get into it, make sure you are aware of whether or not you can get across to the Bitcoin conference. If you can get there, if medical requirements, I mean, there's a non-zero chance all of this could be dropped. So keep a very, very close eye on travel regulations. But they're updating speakers all the time. I've just checked now. They've got Jordan Peterson, who's going across there, Cynthia Lummis, JP Spears, the comedian. And then you're going to have Nayib Bukele, Sailor. It's going to be huge. I'm fingers fully crossed that we can get there, and I hope to see as many plebs there as possible. Day one will be Industry Day. That's where you can meet and greet all of the people in the space that are building. You can network yourself, find some investors or find some employees. And then day two and three are going to be all the speeches from the people that I just mentioned. Day four is going to be rounded out by Sound and Money Fest, headlined by rapper and fellow Bitcoiner Logic. Then you've got Steve Aoki, CL, Run the Jewels, San Holo, Dead Mouse, and many more. Use the link in the show notes and you will get 10% off, or use the code BITTEN at checkout for 10% off all your ticket purchases. And please make sure you're stacking. You know where to do that now. If you're in the US, long time sponsor of the show, Swan Bitcoin. Thank you so much, guys. SwanBitcoin.com/BITTEN. Go start stacking with those guys. That will unlock a free $10 for you. Similar app in the UK and across Europe, Relay, RELAI.ch. Go and check them out. If you want to stack with an exchange, you can use coincorner.com, and they are based in the Isle of Man. They will serve the UK and Euro plebs, no problem. Bring it on. As well as Bitcoin Reserve, you can stack daily with them with card purchases up to £1,000 on their Flash service or Euros. Or you can use their white glove service, Concierge, 50 grand or more. Go check them out. That's Bitcoin Reserve. All the links are in the show notes to these companies. And finally, you know what I always tell you, get yourself a damn hardware wallet. It's so important. There's no reason to not do that. Bitbox O2 by Shift Crypto. That will save you 5%. Shiftcrypto.ch/bitten. It's so important that you do take control of these keys, of these coins. With that said, with all the shills finished, thank you everybody for listening. And you know, if you're using the streaming services such as Fountain App or Breeze, I really appreciate it. These are just going to get better and better as time goes by, and it's a great way to interact. So thank you for listening. Enjoy this show with Jonathan. All right, Lauren, we are recording with Jonathan.
Yeah.
You're standing on hot coals here to ask him a question. Yes. So fire away.
So I heard that you are kind of like a doctor, like you are like, that he said that you are a doctor. So my first question is, why did you become a doctor? Like, why did you want to help people with that
thing? Okay, well, great to meet Lauren. I think I'm probably gonna, feels like I'm getting off easy with this question, but initially went into medicine because I thought it was interesting. I am the fourth generation physician in the family. So several doctors before me, and I thought what they were doing was a positive, and you know, it provided a good lifestyle that they were able to have with families. So kind of dual angle there. And when I thought about kind of doing other, you know, potential routes, whether in finance or something else, I saw an increased risk where the risk with going into medicine was low.
Okay. And my next question, is it hard being a doctor?
Is it hard? Yeah, sometimes. Sometimes it can be really hard and it can be really rewarding. So there's a dual polarity there. I practiced as a hospitalist. So that's a physician that takes care of people in the hospital. So if you ever get sick and you have to go to a hospital, I'd be the one of the doctors that brings you into the hospital and then takes care of you. And most of the time, people go to the hospital because they're either really ill or they find something out that is very detrimental. So sometimes people will have a symptom and then they'll go to the hospital and they'll find out that they have cancer, and having to talk people through having their new diagnosis, that this is a, you know, could be what is a significant life-changing event, and helping them work through, that's a very difficult piece, and kind of, you know, that can kind of wear on individuals as they have to deliver that news on a routine basis. And then there's also really positive times when someone is very ill, but we're able to intervene and deliver really acute care that allows someone to get better and be able to spend more time with their friends and family. So, you know, there's two kind of roads there that kind of equal out the total experience of being a physician.
Right. Okay. And wait, so you know Bitcoin, right?
Yeah.
Okay. So why do you like Bitcoin?
They all three. Yeah, I think I do way too much into Bitcoin.
We kind of lost you a little bit there. Did you hear Lauren's question?
Yeah, I said that I have three children myself, and they all three think I spend way too much time on Bitcoin.
For us, because we basically think the same thing.
Right. Yeah, but there's four of you ganging up on me. But so your definitive question, why do you like Bitcoin?
I like Bitcoin because it empowers the individual, and I think providing the individual tools, or like when I was a physician, providing the individual information so that they can live a better, more fulfilled life is important. And, you know, if I'm going to, you know, dedicate my time and my energy, then I want to, you know, put that effort into a worthy cause. And so I think for me personally, there's nothing more worthy outside of my family than trying to help in any way possible that I can with Bitcoin.
Okay. And I'm going to leave the rest to you, Daddy.
Okay.
I have no more questions.
All right.
So, and plus, if I said all the questions, then you have no more questions.
I have a feeling Jonathan had been primed, like, by Matt and Marty, that maybe, and perhaps even Parker, that he was going to be facing down a lot tougher questions tonight.
Well, I don't have any tough questions. I have all the tough questions for other people, but not him.
Well, one day we'll meet Jonathan, so save it up for that day.
Yeah.
Yeah?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. All right.
Yep. Yep.
Great to meet Lauren.
Bye.
So you said one thing I just picked up on.
Yes.
Yeah, it's okay. I'll go without the earphones. Thank you for checking. You know, the good stuff.
There's...
Yeah. still a physician or was a physician? Have retired? Still practice? What's the current status?
Well, I think I'm gonna always be a physician. In that, you know, I've passed the exam. I practiced for a decade, and kind of beneficial being a physician during a pandemic, especially for let's say a cohort of individuals that are completely skeptic of any establishment. So, being able to provide guidance or advice. To help navigate is something that I'm probably going to be, I'll continue to do, but more on a kind of personal individual basis. I am no longer practicing in the hospital. That ceased last year when kind of my partner and I thought that, you know, what we were doing at the time was really catching on. We felt that, you know, this was something that we both really wanted to do. And so we left our fiat jobs and really pushed forward with the fun piece. But as far as back to practicing, I guess you kind of, I can do that. I'm a physician for life. So I guess I get the opportunity to do both.
All right, cool. So Oh, which rabbit hole to go down? Do we start with the medical rabbit hole or the Bitcoin rabbit hole? And this all ties into, you know, 1031 ultimately, and the work that you're going to be doing. Well, you are doing, and you know, the vision that you have. All right, fourth generation physicians. So generations 1, 2, and 3. Where did they come from? What was the what's the backstory there?
You know, they small town docs that practiced in Illinois and Indiana, kind of in the Midwest, that, you know, took care of communities, which is, you know, one thing that I think is, you know, very special that I found during my time is that even though we didn't practice necessarily in the same specific area, the general geographical area is the same. And I was able to take care of patients that my great grandfather had taken care of or delivered. So like he delivered somebody 90 years ago, and then I was taking care of them, you know, at the end stage of their life. So I think that was something that was pretty unique and special with that kind of lineage, or just being able to meet people that they had taken care of in prior generations. And that I was young when my grandfather passed, and so I didn't necessarily know him to the extent that, you know, would have been, you know, optimal, but being able to see the positive impacts that he had during his life, you know, just being able to see the ripple, like you drop the stone in, but yet you're still being able to see the ripple at the end of the pond is, I thought was pretty interesting.
That's wild. And Kirkwood is, I mean, there's British heritage in there somewhere, or what's the?
I think that's Scott. The when I've looked it up, it's Scottish. Mm-hmm. Is the where the surname comes from, and yeah, that originally.
That there's some brave people there. They come across to the States a couple of hundred years ago.
Yeah, I actually don't know where the first one came in. I just know I've seen some paper clippings of when the first Dr. Kirkwood went into Southern Illinois, but I don't know. I don't know the history as well as probably I should.
So what's the process then? Trying to, you know, for somebody that's never been down the rabbit hole of going to medical school and all of this kind of, or we get as plebs, as noobs or whatever normies, we get exposed to like the TV shows, right? You know, mm-hmm. It's hard work. Can you do the internships or what do you call them? The
residencies,
right. How does that compare to what you actually went through? I mean, are we just sold some dream on television, or like, is there some kind of truth to this? Like,
you know, there's a lot of dramatization, but you know, there is some truth to it. It reminds me of this, what happened in when I was in medical school, rotating at Cook County, and I guess there was this like power marathon of all the ER episodes of like multiple seasons that was happening at that time. And we were just I was in the ER, we were just pounding through patients, and this, I go in to review this next patient, and he's like, why are you here? He's like, well, the guy was high as could be. And he's like, I was watching this, you know, ER marathon. And I was like, why am I watching it on TV when I can watch it in real life? And so honest to God, the why he was there. And so the attending at the time just got him a chair and put him there in the ER, like, and just he sat there for a while and then was gone at some point. So I guess maybe it wasn't as entertaining as what the TV show makes it out to be.
Who was hoping for George Clooney to come for reason through? I mean, like, this is crazy.
Yeah, I don't know, but as far as kind of the oddities, I mean, I think this is, there's just so many variabilities in, each human and each, so your the possibilities of something coming through the hospital or coming through medicine, like, it just doesn't shock you what humans will do to themselves or can happen as far as an accident goes, or, you know, can cause an issue with why you would need to go to the hospital. So that is probably very true. Like, those situations are really being derived from some type of experience that did happen in the hospital.
Yeah, I'm sure. I mean, as a script writer for that stuff, you have carte blanche, right? I mean, anything could happen, right? It's I'm sure.
Yeah, but nothing. Nothing is stranger than fiction.
Mm-hmm. So what was your job then? What was your exact, like, specific role? And I'm sure it, you know, progressed since like your first couple of years on the job to like your last couple of years on the job, but just for the listeners and those of us that have never been in this position, you know, what would the day-to-day look like?
Oh, as a hospitalist, and this is what I did for the last decade, or when a patient would either come through the ER, a patient would be in the outpatient setting, so in a doctor's office or another hospital, I would get a call that said, hey, I got someone sick. I would need to find out kind of the more of the history, the story, And then we'd be like, okay, that person's sick enough. They need to come into the hospital, or, you know, that person's really not at the stage that needs to come in the hospital. I would recommend doing A, B, or C, you know, follow up, you know, X time, or, you know, this person needs really to have, you know, this procedure. So why don't you send them to this place? And then if someone needed to come into the hospital, then I would go see the patient, evaluate them, bring them in, and then take care of them while they're in the hospital. And then if I was still on during the time when the patient was in the hospital, then either discharge them or hand them off to one of my partners to take over.
What was the, you know, again, really basic question. I think you've already answered the question, like, you know, the most bizarre thing you've seen with the guy coming in thinking he was part of like a film set. What was the worst thing you've seen in the 10 years of doing that?
Oh, I mean, the worst is when you got to deliver bad news. Like, just, you know, too many times that, you know, so you know, the adage, you know, I was never sick until I ever went to the hospital. Like, that's a common adage that people use. And there are a lot of times when, you know, someone will have retired and they'll just be retired after 3 months, and then they'll come in and, you know, we'll find that they have metastatic cancer, and, you know, there's really not going to be anything to be able to do other than, you know, go into hospice care and potentially expire in the next 3 to 6 months. Or when, you know, you have a young person, and there's the phrase young enough to die. So typically when you delineate young and old, like, the people who have made it to old age, like, they're going to survive, but the young people, they're just young enough to die. And having to deliver, you know, tough news to a parent that, you know, their child is not going to make it, or is going to be impaired for the rest of their life. I mean, those are tough situations that you you unfortunately have to do, but that's just part of life, part of the process, the wheel that we're all on.
Yeah, I can't imagine that. It's not much more to be said there, especially for those people that are, you know, recently retired, right? I mean, it's such a common story, it seems. And now, being in the Bitcoin space, having had our heads turned upside down as to what's actually going on in the fiat space, with how our time is stolen from us every single second of every single day. And the guy that walks in that's 70 and he's just kind of released the chains, and you got to deliver that news. Ugh. I mean, how long has Bitcoin been in your life then? How many years did that overlap with what you were doing? Because that must have started changing your whole mindset as to, like, the kind of things you were seeing, and, like, needless things as well.
I mean, I think a lot of times, like, you'll have to have some big shock moment to wake you up from the slumber that you're in. And I mean, I, like everybody else, I had touch points throughout time, throughout the last decade of, you know, where I would venture sort of into Bitcoin, but, you know, I didn't buy anything. Or I think I tried to run Bitcoin Core a long time ago, and my computer started, like, buzzing. So I was like, oh, left that. And then when I got out of residency, you know, I had a DEA license. And so that's the license that you need to be able to prescribe narcotics. And I looked at Bitcoin because of Silk Road. And when the Ross Ulbricht story broke, I followed it. And I was like, oh, well, I don't want to jeopardize my DEA license, so I can't, I didn't want to venture in it there. So really it was until the last probably 4 years that I really started going down the rabbit hole into Bitcoin. And then really 2019 was when I would say full on only Bitcoin is where that probably was the year that it started for the to really understand and see, you know, that Bitcoin was this great aligner of incentives. And once you turn on those orange lenses, like you see the other problems then and why like the situations you were in before didn't always line up or settle right. You knew something wasn't right, but you didn't know exactly, you know, what that common thread was.
Did you feel that, I mean, personally, like within the family, or was it more like the people that you were seeing every single day, like, you know, that there's something, you know, ailments aside or whatever else, but it's like there's just something not connecting. Like, why are people not happy? Why are people not as healthy as they should be? Why am I not happy? Why are we still struggling to meet, you know, monthly bills or whatever?
I want to the original thing that I saw that, you know, I just was having such a tough time working through was being a physician and operating within a hospital system. And so you can be, I went from being a private hospitalist to being an employed hospitalist when we made a move. And there is a big change there as far as how you were treated, the relationship. And it went from, you know, being having this autonomy to make decisions and make, you know, as best decisions as you can, to when you went to this employed model, to having someone that was, you know, looking over your shoulder or, you know, doing something for the hospital instead. And so not where you weren't making the necessarily the best decisions for the patient. You were making, you know, okay, you're making, trying to make good decisions for the patient, but knowing that the hospital system was the reason you had employment. And so if a patient, you know, if you knew the patient was just a substance abuser and they were coming in trying to get narcotics, you could, you know, say, you know, I'm not giving you narcotics. If you were in private practice, but with being employed, then they go on their, which called their age caps, you know, potential having a negative review, and then that can hurt the brand of the hospital, or, you know, you need to, you do X, Y, and Z. So, you know, there was a malalignment in incentives, and I didn't quite understand why or how that, you know, that kind of built out. And so I got my my MBA, and I think it was during the time when I was getting my MBA that, you know, putting together costs of capital and, you know, the reasoning why hospitals were able to buy up the productive resources that actually produced value, which were physicians and physicians' practices, is that, you know, they had the ability to access, you know, the lowest cost of capital, whereas it was a, you know, an individual or a multi-specialty group just weren't able to access that same low cost of capital as a municipality or a large healthcare system. And I mean, that was kind of the first started realization, like there's something wrong here that prevents, you know, an individual from making the best decision because there is this existential threat of blowback.
So you're trapped right in the Cantillon effect right there.
Yeah, no, it was terrible. But it's true. And I think that's, I mean, one of the reasons why, like, there's such a burnout on physicians, or, you know, there are so many pieces of them are being pulled, and they're having to run faster and faster to maintain that same output, same output, whether in a monetary or a productive capacity, because you have inflation, but then you would have, you know, whether Congress, you know, would change the reimbursement rates, or Medicare, Medicaid would change the reimbursement rates and lower the floors on a procedure or code. Like, there was just no getting out of that system.
And that's, I think, correct me if I'm wrong, but I think you're touching on, like, the other side of what I see is, like, the incentives driven by the whole insurance industry. So on one side, you've got this access to low-cost capital, as you would say. Like, you know, you're sitting very close to the Cantillon effect, so you can get that cheap money, and then you can buy out private hospitals or practices or whatever else and bring them into you to, you know, make you bigger and more monopolized. But then you've got the incentives coming in from the insurance companies that are, well, correct me if I'm wrong, but you're incentivized to prescribe certain things or certain procedures over others because they get more of a payout or less of a payout. I'm kind of sketchy on what's going on.
Yeah, with insurance, and there's a lot of partnerships that are now occurring to decrease the waste, but decrease the expenditure on each patient. So, like, we had a negotiation where we got X number of the insurance company, and then the group partnered with the insurance company that said, you're going to get X number of dollars for each patient each year. And then there was a revenue or a split on cost savings, where if you maintain costs below X, then you would get like a 50-50 split on that savings. So, but there's a ton of waste within the delivery of care. So I do think, like, I was on multiple committees that, you know, looked at, you know, ways to just decrease the overutilization of resources. But I don't think that's necessarily the best approach, or now when I look at the situation, because I think there should be better ways for the delivery of care to individual patients. And I'm excited to see somehow Bitcoin, you know, be infused in the delivery of care, where, you know, you can deliver, you know, a service, you know, get that denominated in Bitcoin or in some way, so that, you know, that time that you expended is stored, or where patients are able to access resources that aren't priced at a monopolistic rate. We talk about, like, MRIs, and with an MRI and an MRI machine, they're expensive, expensive to run, but they're always on. And so if you go to any city, you know, that means that MRI machine is turned on 24 hours a day. Like, I don't know why someone isn't going after the other 12 hours of the day and just allowing people to, you know, to come in, pay $200 for an MRI, and then another, you know, $200 to have it red, so $400 to have an MRI, because that's it. Otherwise, it's a sunk cost because it's already turned on. Now there's some variable cost where you have to employ somebody to run the machine while the person's in it. But I mean, that's a very small variable cost for the fixed compared to the fixed cost of already having the machine. So I think like there's a lot of opportunities there where services will become more available. And some of that is happening in kind of larger cities, larger institutions where people may have a private machine that they have available. But I just don't know why you're not offering that service to right now to people to be able to pay and just have a screening MRI for $400 where they can have a whole body screening MRI. It just makes too much sense to me, given the fact that you already have the infrastructure in place.
Exactly. That's just a complete, I mean, what you've just explained is nonsense. If it's there and if it's on and if people are willing to come in and pay, think of what you could catch, you know, early, you know, and then treat those people in that hospital.
Yeah, no, that it's very true. There's a kind of a dichotomy of ideas where, you know, you don't look for something unless, you know, you're wanting to find something. But I think that some of that is kind of an age old, you know, ideology that we just didn't have the resources that we have today. And we look at those things as, you know, high cost when in fact they shouldn't be high cost. And I mean, my mindset has changed over time to where, you know, I think we should be doing much more advanced screening than what we currently are, because, you know, you find something and then that can be significantly important to that one person. And this is where I think that this comes to, there's a difference between an individual and we'll say an insurance company. So an insurance company, their role is to deliver the best care for the lowest amount. That's their model. And they're basing everything off of, you know, probability of managing a cohort. So, and the individual is completely their decisions. And so this is where what I was kind of coining as the general soldier dilemma, where, you know, if you want to win the war, so the general wants to win the war, the soldier wants to win the war, but the general's willing to take on, you know, a 5% loss to win the war. Whereas to that individual soldier, that 5% is actually an infinite loss, because the soldier has only one life. So it's an infinite loss to that individual soldier. So that 5% risk is significant to the individual. And so I think the individual would be more likely to kind of to pay for a service that can even further kind of mitigate their individual risk, compared to kind of a larger organization that is managing total risk.
Yeah. I get the feeling there are too many administrators and bureaucrats in the in between of the physicians and the patients and the patient's well-being.
Yeah, I think this is just the system, the fiat system that we're in, and this is just all slowly compounded over time to where you have this large wedge in between patients and direct physician care and direct physician management.
What I've always found kind of bizarre about hospitals, and please don't take this the wrong way, but you know, we have spent time in hospitals, especially after, you know, the birth of our kids. The level of it's almost the worst place to recover. Like the quality of food and the quality of rest are pretty low. What are your thoughts on that?
That was my favorite joke when patients would complain about rest. I would promptly inform them that sleeping was against hospital policy, and that would stop any further complaints, because they'd at least get a smile out of that, or, you know, a second look. But I also, you know, I didn't think that patients were supposed to be in the hospital for recovery. So soon as, you know, you recovered at home, soon as you were able to go home, I was sending you home. And that meant that if there was no other service that I was providing to you or that you needed in the hospital, so there was no kind of continued convalescing in the hospital when I was managing.
You, man. And the food?
Yeah, I mean, that's just terrible. But now we have Uber Eats, and
you got Uber Eats. You can have that delivered bedside nowadays.
And sometimes, but I mean, there were plenty of times that I would go into patients' rooms, like after heart attacks. After a heart attack, you would see McDonald's because their spouse would bring it into them. It wasn't even a novel joke anymore. Just having it in there, and so, I mean, that was it. Like, I would tell patients, like, don't change your diets. I don't care what you eat. I can adjust the medication around your lifestyle because it's too difficult to try to have them, especially for what I did, was being such a subacute or acute care, that you couldn't make any, there was no progress to be made in trying to adjust someone's behaviors. So it was just far easier to adjust, turn a dial with a medication or add a medication to optimize that person's health.
How much better would the landscape look within the health system, within hospital system, if people had correct nutrition information available to them? Like, you know, the whole idea of this food pyramid being turned upside down. What are your thoughts on that?
I mean, I think that individuals will take the least encumbered path. And right now, the least encumbered path is, I mean, fast food is poor nutrition. So, you know, the health pyramid, I mean, I would be willing to wager that you could put that in front of anybody and 90% wouldn't know which level contains what. So I don't think that's necessarily that important. I think that being able to deliver healthy meals, or, you know, being able that people can access some type of a good diet, it'd be just far easier to do it that way. Just something easy for them to access, and then something that's streamlined and, you know, low cost. And, you know, I think that goes back to, you know, they're having to choose low cost because they don't have any purchasing power, because the overall, you know, in the U.S., you know, the vast majority of middle class have been pushed out, and we're in inflation, and Bitcoin fixes this. So
it truly does. All right. So let's get down to, you know, what happened back end of 2019, probably the start of 2020 for you guys over in the US. You'd have been, what, 8 or 9 years into your career at this point?
Yeah, I think so. That's probably right.
And then all of a sudden,
after residency.
Then all of a sudden, we have the news of COVID-19, and we have the for you guys, you would have seen all of the Chinese news coming out, and then Europe getting hit, and then, you know, it's on your doorstep. What was going on in the walls of the hospital beforehand? And then, you know, like, you know, when you were first seeing this thing, was it kind of, yeah, whatever, or we got to be ready? What was the kind of state of affairs?
Well, initially, I remember getting, I mean, we all watched the videos of the people passing out. And I remember talking to the doc that sat next to me in our office. And I'm like, hey, are you watching this? And he's like, yeah, and he agreed, didn't know necessarily what to think of it. But it was, you know, a lot of unknown and uncertainty. Didn't know at the time what was coming. You know, it could, I mean, there's such a wide range of what it could be and how serious, you know, that necessarily, you know, it could be, or could be a big nothing burger. I mean, it was just complete unknown. And I had a biotech fund a few years before, and so I had really like being able to review the data that was coming out and kind of helping to delineate, you know, what was kind of signal and what was just noise, helped out in the initial beginning. But yeah, I mean, we were having weekly meetings starting, I believe, in February, March, about how we were going to handle the surge, because we were where I practiced was a referral center. And so we were expected to, you know, cut the place where I practice has probably 400,000 that the direct that it treats. But then, you know, we were thinking,
where was,
you know,
this maybe, geographically?
Southern Indiana.
Okay.
So, you know, but there's, you know, multiple states that sit around that we could be being filtered to, or, you know, being filtered to us. So, you know, we just didn't know. And we didn't know how much resources that we had or we were going to need. So, I mean, we all made the jokes with the brown paper bag and how, you know, that just kept everyone safe. And but you just kind of did what you had to do when things were coming our way.
What did happen?
Well, a big nothing burger at first. I mean, we didn't have hardly any patients. They would trickle in here and there, but this was during kind of that initial lockdowns. And so the ICUs weren't full, but after a couple of months, I mean, our ICU beds were full, our hospital beds were full. And so, I mean, there was shortages. But I mean, we knew in May who the at-risk groups were. And I mean, that hasn't changed. It's your advanced age, obesity and morbid obesity. And then those with some type of lung pathology. So if you'd had a history of, you know, significant COPD, CHF, and then obviously with diabetes, hypertension. But, you know, it was a lot of times it was people that, you know, didn't go get care early. Like they would let something linger for, you know, 1 to 2 weeks, and then they would go, they'd come into the hospital and their oxygen saturation would be in the 70s. And, you know, then you'd be putting them on a ventilator in 2 days. So like that was a very common common theme.
What were you seeing in the mainstream media or from other colleagues in the field to what was going on in your actual building? Was that making sense at the time?
I couldn't believe that they were shutting everything down. I thought that and this was given the history with biotech, given the MBA, and just the looking at the situation from a whole, I thought the overall cure was going to the cure was would cost more than the disease, and that, you know, by shutting things down, and this is, you know, what we see in medicine. So when the body shuts down, so if someone has a cardiac arrest, their heart stops, they're not, blood flow isn't being pumped throughout the body. And we have techniques and procedures to be able to have resumption of circulation, but you don't see damage until 2-3 days out. So even though you bring someone back and they can be talking to you, you know, they could be going, you're not going to know the kidney failure, the liver failure, until 2-3 days out, maybe a week, maybe 5 days out. And, you know, it's the same thing. I think that's any complex system, and that's what's just what the body is. The body is 11 systems that are integrated, and with an economy, you have enormous systems that are integrated. And you shut it down, you're not going to see the backups for a significant amount of time. And so I was expecting when like we're shutting things down, okay, we're not going to see something for, you know, 18 months from now, you know, something play out. But whenever I would say that in the physician's lounge, yeah, I would be looked at like, you know, you're crazy. Like that's not really accurate, or, you know, we have to do these things now. But
and then there's I mean, I don't know how much of a dark road this is to go down, but there's been reports that some hospitals were, you know, just to keep themselves alive and profitable, that there were subsidies offered to hospitals to put people on ventilators. Is that true? Do you know?
No, I don't. I actively, you know, co-managed those patients, and I don't recall that occurring. Now, you had what were called utilization managers, and those were people that were trying to help with coding. You know, it was always, you know, a sticking point if someone had COVID to make sure that they were being diagnosed with COVID or COVID was attributable to their death. I think that's what a lot of an EMR, the electronic medical record, is doesn't really have much to do with providing care as it is for facilitating billing.
Yeah, man, there's so much here. There's like trying to sift through what's been going on, you know, the truths from the mistruths, the information from the misinformation. It's so difficult, especially for people that are sitting on the outside of things. It must be especially difficult for you guys that are sitting on the inside of things, where you are seeing, you know, patients come in, like you said, that have these comorbidities and are of this high risk. But at the same time, we're being pushed a narrative through our TV sets that everyone's at risk and we're all going to die. And we've all got to put masks on and we've all got to stay home. And then, you know, that morphs into now you've all got to start taking, you know, vaccines.
Yeah, no, I mean, this goes in end of February, beginning of March, I started to wear a mask around the hospital. And someone chased me down from infection control to let me know, or to for me to take my mask off. And that is not the hospital's recommendation to wear masks. That's not a point.
So 2020.
Yeah, this was in 2020.
Huh. Okay.
So and this was when we didn't know when, you know, didn't know what was coming or the extent of it. And so I was like, well, you know, you're behind the eight ball. I'm Dr. Kirkwood and I'm going to do what I'm going to do. And, you know, just went about the business. But that's, I think that's it was a very point in time that, you know, the individual has to make decisions and, you know, let, you know, I'll be the person that decides what my decisions are. I'm not going to allow anybody else to make the decisions, and I'll try to make as best a decision I can with the information that I have at that point in time. And that's what I had always done throughout my practicing, whether with any patient. It didn't matter, you know, who you were, it didn't matter how old you were. I tried to make the best decision at that point in time with that information that I had for the individual patient. And, you know, if you allow others to think for you, then you just become dependent on that. And I think the vast majority of the world has chosen that easy path of outsourcing their thinking for them.
At what point did it all start kind of changing for you? What was kind of the arc as this was playing out? Because it's been 2 years now. So we've had the initial fear spell, the initial worry. There was nothing on your doorstep to begin with. Then they start trickling in.
Mm-hmm.
At what point did, you know, like it either peak or a red flag was raised for you with the narrative? Do you remember? Was there anything in particular?
Yeah, I mean, I was over this in May of 2020. I was like, we should, you know, allow this to just, you know, burn through and not allow this to slowly propagate through society. And that was my initial thoughts. And I still think that's what we should have done to this day. But, you know, when I reviewed the study, when Pfizer released their information for the first vaccine, and, you know, it didn't really decrease the amount of, well, one, they didn't test for COVID, they just tested for symptoms, but it really didn't decrease the hospitalizations or symptoms. I was like, oh, well, this really wasn't what I was expecting it to be. But then when, you know, they made these, I wasn't expecting the early EUA decisions that they made. And then when I review, because you can review the discussions that, you know, there really wasn't discussions. I was like, this is absurd. This is just the politicization of it.
Right. So when it became political, that was just like, the same for me. I think it was just like, once it was clear that this was being politicized and there was huge amounts of money at stake, I didn't want any part of the narrative anymore. It was like, no, this is that there's something else going on here. And that the ridiculous amounts of collusion around the world, like it was like, I don't, like, nothing. I could make no sense of anything.
I don't necessarily know if, like, it was collusion or more just, you know, congruent malincentives that, you know, that individuals were just making decisions, and they were all making similar decisions because of the easy path that, you know, was being laid out because of all the prior things that have like been built up over the last 100 years. It's fiat, it's, you know, the technological advances that we've made and that we're still working through how humanity interacts with those technological advancements. I mean, in medicine, you know, typically any new treatment or modality, it takes, you know, a generation to accept. And that's because the old guard doesn't accept something new. The new guard, you know, accepts it. And so there's just this slow progression of, you know, accepting advancements. But, you know, we're in this age where, you know, you have the ability to order a meal and have it delivered to you from, you know, within 20 minutes. I mean, like even that's a hard, you know, advancement to, you know, how do you actually interact with, and what's an appropriate, healthy way to interact with.
All right. I got to ask the elephant in the room question, about vaccines and, like you said, that you saw the first one come around and it wasn't as efficient as you were expecting. And then number two comes around and then number three comes around. And for me, being a noob to this whole thing, you know, I've taken vaccines in my life. Of course I have. Like, I think many people mm-hmm. listening to this podcast probably have. You know, it has to work. It has to immunize you. But here we are three deep and Omicron has just gone burning through everybody as if nobody's been injected with anything, you know, prior to this. It's the common thread is, but it lowers your symptoms, or it's you know, it gives you less of a reaction, which to me is, from if I build on from first principles of what is a vaccine should immunize you, that there shouldn't be a number two and there shouldn't be a number three. And if it does come, it shouldn't be a less symptoms effect. It should be, no, you're immunized. Is that kind of like a real layman's way of looking at it?
Well, let's take this back. So the coronavirus is an RNA virus and it can easily replicates, and that during replication, you know, you can have mutations, and then those mutations are what, you know, why we went from the original strain to alpha, beta, delta, Omicron. Like, so that was going to happen no matter what.
That's kind of what viruses do, right?
Yeah. Most of the part, there's some viruses that will have a stable protein that you can specifically isolate, and that protein or epitope is stable, and you can target it. And so that's why some vaccines we can completely eradicate, and other viruses that we can't, and we will never be able to eradicate. So that's point number one. Point number two is, I mean, COVID is definitely the original COVID-19 and Delta. Those are real. There are people who got sick and died that had we not had COVID-19, they wouldn't have died. There would have been no reason that you would have anticipated that they would have died from a health standpoint. And, you know, some of these people were in their 50s. So they were young, in their 50s, 60s. Now they may have had other comorbidities that caused them to be more susceptible to having an adverse reaction from COVID-19 and deteriorating and passing. So, for one, COVID's going to mutate. That's going to happen no matter whether we have vaccines. Two, COVID is real and people died. So in medicine, we deal with reducing fraction or reducing just percentage points in risk. So one example that we use is atrial fibrillation. So if someone has atrial fibrillation, and that's where the heart doesn't just say beat appropriately, if you don't do anything, you'll have a 5% chance of having a stroke a year. So if you flip that around the other way, 95% chance of, you know, not having a stroke a year just by having AFib. To somebody normally, they'll like, oh, I'll take that bet, you know, day in, day out. But in medicine, you know, we'll say, okay, well, if you put you on a baby aspirin, then we can reduce you to 3% risk. So that's a relative risk reduction of 40%. And then let's say someone needs to go on, you know, an anticoagulant. So warfarin or some of the direct thrombin inhibitors, you know, that can lower your overall risk of having a stroke to 2%. So going from 3% to 2% is a 30% relative risk reduction, which is huge. Or going from 5% to 2%, you know, is a 60% relative risk reduction. So, I mean, those are pretty significant. And this, I think, goes back to the general soldier dilemma, where an individual, a 5% chance of having a stroke, which can be fatal, or, you know, potentially worse than being fatal, is, you know, being immobilized or, completely or paralyzed from having a stroke. That's life ruining. Like you're never going to have the chance to run and play or run and interact with society again. So those are those small percentage points that, you know, we're going after can really improve overall quality of life. And so if you take that same kind of mindset and you take it to the vaccines, then yes, for people that have, you know, 5 years, 10 years or 20, like you're at the end stage, you're looking at, and that can really decrease their risk of dying. So if we look at time, and, you know, someone in their 20s has, they're a billion second. They have a billion seconds. And so each second, the overall value divided by a billion is a lot less than if you have 5 years and that same value of time is more. So, you know, I think the vaccines probably did a good job in the really at-risk populations. Now, do we know all of the adverse events that occurred from vaccines? I mean, we don't know those. We can see that those things are being reported, but I mean, they were like the general practitioner of medicine is not the person that's supposed to be reporting adverse events from vaccines. Like that's why clinical trial, and that's why clinical trials, you make whoever is instituting the clinical trial makes a ton of money. And it's because of the parameters that those trials are in. So I think over time, we're going to find out exactly, you know, how much risk there is in the vaccines. But given that we don't know that, I can say that the people that did have the vaccines, you know, there probably were life saved.
Yeah. The red flags for me for the whole thing were the amount of like marketing that went into these things, the mandating in some countries, you know, being a Bitcoiner like yourself, it's all about individual choice. You cannot mandate a medical procedure over someone. This is just complete nonsense because you have everybody is completely individual, not down to their choice, but down to their, you know, the makeup of their body. Like there is, you're going to harm people if you blanket mandate even aspirin, right? Am I crazy?
No, I mean, look, I mean, everyone needs water, but too much of it and you can drown.
Right.
So agreed. And this goes back to the incentives of the system and how the system is set up. I wrote a paper some years ago about drug companies, drug development, and what they do to maintain their exclusivity. So you can have a patent for a drug, but typically the patents aren't long enough because it takes a considerable amount of time to develop the drug. And so then the government, the FDA provides exclusivity for an additional amount of time so that a company can market the drug. And I mean, they're a business, and their business is to sell their drug. And there are direct attempts to, you know, how they market that drug to maintain or to increase, you know, sales. I mean, that's their incentive. And so that's what they do to carry that out. But what is being marketed is kind of fuzzy compared to, you know, what is kind of done on the back end, or what's provided, or what the physicians have the ability or the time to go in and do the evaluation of the drug itself and comparable analysis to other drugs. You're just told, you know, you're informed, you know, this drug is the best that we have, even though it only slightly improves off of, you know, prior ones that are on, you know, a generic list.
Yeah, it's and again, I don't know that you've had the same problem in the States. Correct me if I'm wrong, but over here in Europe, we're seeing each week now either a player on the field of a football game or somebody in the stadium. You know, and you look at the demographic, like the demographic is, you know, 10 to 70-year-old men. There's a game stopped each week now, because there's been a cardiac arrest in the stadium, or there's been, you know, a player has collapsed on the field of play. It blows my mind that there's not more being said. Red flags aren't being raised. They're still marketing the product heavily. Just today, my brother received a letter to tell him, you got to come in to get your third shot from the NHS. So they're actively pushing this. I mean, it's like a well-funded marketing, slick corporate operation.
Mm-hmm.
And then when I think about the amount of money that's being made behind the scenes here by the big companies, by the Pfizers, Modernas, AstraZenecas, Johnson & Johnson, you name them, it's classic loss-leading MBA style corporate sales at the detriment of, you know, some of the people that are, you know, they're even kids, mate, like kids.
But I mean, this is a multifactorial dynamic situation where you have all of the players with kind of, it's not corrupted incentives, but the incentives are not optimal. Where we've talked about the drug companies where they want to sell, and mm-hmm. you know, that's their incentive. You know, you have hospitals, healthcare organizations that, you know, operate on a 1-2% profit margin. Mm-hmm. I mean, they're you know, barely profitable, and the government you know, is able to start handing you large, you know, reimbursements to do X, Y, and Z, you know, to maintain, you know, a vaccination level of X, then, you know, you get, you know, a large chunk of capital, or, you know, you're allowed, you know, higher reimbursement rates. You have, you know, over time, I mean, with the current physicians, you know, there's a significant amount of student loan debt that these physicians have, and that's why they're employed. And so, you know, now you can, you know, what weighs on your decision when, you know, you have a family and you're the main provider for that family? Are you going to buck the system when, you know, someone's telling you that, you know, you need to do, you know, you need to treat this way, or you can't prescribe this, or you have to do that? You know, I don't think that there's any one, you know, isolated piece that you can say, you know, this is what's wrong. Like the whole part of this is just malincentives or inhibiting, you know, what should be, you know, the best decisions to occur.
Bitcoin fixes this?
Yeah, I mean, I do. I think that Bitcoin is this great aligner of incentives that, you know, I had a health scare a few years ago, and, you know, at the time, the model that I had was, you know, I can't change the past. The future is too uncertain. So I'm just going to make good decisions today and let that compound into a great outcome. Like that was my mental model. And I think with Bitcoin, when people are able to make good decisions and being able to store those good decisions in, you know, in the form of your encrypted energy of Bitcoin, that, you know, over time, you know, they're going to reap significant benefits. And we can't change the past like that. The other piece that drives me crazy is I don't understand why people want to try to change the past, because everything had to play out exactly the way it was for you to be at this moment where you are today. But the future is, there's too much variability. There's too many, you know, possibilities. You can't comprehend, you know, what may or may not be, but you can just focus on making good decisions. And when we have the entire population, you know, focusing on good decisions and being able to store those good decisions, like, I think it's unbelievable where we're going to be in the next 50 years or 100 years, let alone, you know, if you, you know, thinking about the people that go out 1,000 years. I mean, that's like, this is a real fundamental change for humanity to progress to, you know, the next, you know, it's not really evolution, but the next step function, I think, in the coordination of communication and value for our species.
100% agreed. Totally agreed. And I'm interested now to know, like, you must have reached the point. Did you leave your fiat role, or did you escape? You know, what was the kind of mindset at that point?
Yeah. It was, you know, there was a force function that I had to go. I mean, I was fortunate enough that, I mean, I was only actually practicing 1 week a month. So 7 days on, 21 days off. And I was very fortunate enough to be able to do that for quite a few years. And that allowed me to really focus, you know, a lot of my time on learning about Bitcoin. And I mean, I try to explain or make the comparison that learning about Bitcoin, I'm spending just as much time as I did in medical school trying to learn about medicine. And I mean, that's all you did in for 4 years, actually 7 years with medical school and residency, was just read, learn, and work at it. And it's kind of been that same way in Bitcoin. Very fortunate that people like yourself do podcasts and you're able to consume content, you know, like significant amount of content from the best thought leaders in the space, you know, that have had the opportunity to refine their ideas and their approaches to deliver, you know, great content. So I had the time to be able to do that, and very fortunate that my cousin, which is my partner, my business partner, we were also talking about Bitcoin a lot, and then finding, you know, investments for us to invest in personally, and then just really following our passion to where we are today.
And it was this is 1031. Was this the birth of 1031 as it is today? Like what?
Yeah,
what,
that's, how did that? Yeah, that the birth of 1031 was really that we came across Unchained Capital and just enamored with that idea that, you know, we were able to, you know, like, willingly throw them our money and just take it, please take it.
They were the first investment.
Yeah, they were the first for personally for us. And so, you know, that idea of just being able to try to help push Bitcoin forward, because, you know, we're not coders, we're not developers, but we have other skills that we can bring to do our part to, you know, to see to try to build the future that we envision for ourselves.
I gotta tell you right now, the plebs are probably screaming, like, why didn't you just buy sats? Like, why invest in a company when you just go long the asset?
That's a very good question. And how I approached that question at the time, because this was when Bitcoin was sub 10,000. And, you know, that we tell people to DCA. Don't try to time the market, just DCA, and it'll be hard to beat that. So my thought was the same with companies, that if a company was producing value that didn't exist before, then that value had a premium. And if the company operates on a Bitcoin standard, that their profits, their balance sheet is going to probably be denominated in Bitcoin. And so the value that they produced on a daily basis allows that company to stack sats, to DCA in. And if a company is producing value to the market, then that company will attract more customers, which increases cash flow. So a company that is building on a Bitcoin standard has two ways for continuing to accrue value. You have the balance sheet appreciation, and then you have cash flow, or what my partner says is sats flow appreciation. And so with those two mechanisms, I think companies will be able to outcompete just buying more Bitcoin, just buying the Bitcoin at the start, because if you think of a profit margin as a discount, then the company is able to acquire Bitcoin below spot, just like a miner is able to change energy and capital in the form of miners into Bitcoin from the distribution of Bitcoin. It's the same thing for a company. And I don't think that there's going to be any better time to have started investing in Bitcoin companies than in 2020, 21, and now, because you had effectively two clearing mechanisms in the market. You had the bear market of 2018, 2019, and then you had COVID come in 2020. And so with two clearing mechanisms back to back, effectively, capital and customers were scarce. And any company that was surviving or kind of born in that time, you know, they had to have something that was producing value. Otherwise, you couldn't attract a customer. No one is going to part with their fiat or their Bitcoin during when times are tough, and forcing those companies to operate, you know, with value, but also forcing them to operate lean. So they've weathered, you know, pretty significant storms. So I think that's where I think that the company, so you have kind of a multiple attributes that companies have that really make them very attractive for, you know, creating these positive sats flow businesses moving forward.
Put it another way, you've outsourced and leveraged your DCA.
Yeah, that's a great point. The outsource, we do think of it as a kind of a leverage play, but in outsourcing the DCA is a very good point.
You know, shareholders of MicroStrategy, for example, you're outsourcing the DCA buyers of Michael Saylor that you are never ever going to be able to ever achieve. Right. So instead you buy the stock. You're saying instead you just buy the companies and you find the Bitcoin only companies that are doing great work. Unchained Capital, a perfect example. Are you allowed to tell us the portfolio or not?
We have a emblem list on our website of companies that we've partnered with.
So and now you've got, correct me if I'm wrong, but I believe you have Parker sitting alongside you guys, Matt O'Dell and Marty Bent.
Yeah, and Michael Tanguma. So, you know, there's that initial thread that I pulled on why we did it is, you know, just echoing in a lot of and pretty well most other Bitcoiners. That, you know, we come in, you come in contact. There's this common thread that I think is woven through all of us, and we've been able to really build up, you know, really good friendships. And you can build a really good friendship in Bitcoin very quickly because you have this foundation that, you know, you may have different life experiences, but there's this common foundation where, you know, when you come together, like you just know you are my friend and I am your friend and we move forward. And that's very similar to what happened with Marty and Matt. I mean, we were freaks just listening to their podcast, just enjoying, you know, never had the thought of being able to partner with them, or, you know, or when I had read the Gradually Then Suddenly series, thinking that, you know, I would ever one, get to meet Parker, two, let alone be, have him on as an advisor. So like, this is, absolutely living a dream for us, being able to, you know, participate in the way we're able to participate in kind of in so many companies, because we've partnered with around 20 companies to date, that, you know, being able to see, you know, what's happening and being a part of that and bringing on, you know, our LPs or, you know, our partners to be able to experience it at the same time, I think is just very fulfilling with the use of my time.
There's going to be more to come, right? Right now, from I've just jotted down what I know off the top of my head. There's you guys. There's Bitcoin Adventures, which is you know, Corey and Stefan and some more of the guys over at Swan. Stephen Cole doing his thing. There's Dan Tapiero from you know, the more kind of mainstream financial world that set up his fund. Are you seeing more of this come your way? That's more focused on Bitcoin, not the shitty A16Z kind of moronic bullshit that we all want to completely ignore.
Yeah, there's, you know, it's still hard to believe that investing, well, that Bitcoin is a contrarian play, and yeah. Investing in Bitcoin companies is your rat poison squared contrarian play. So, I mean, there's not a large pool of players, which, I mean, if you ever start a business or go into business, you want to go where no one else is and, you know, provide that service. So that's a very beneficial, but I mean, we have a great relationship with those people that you've talked with. I mean, I think Bitcoiner Ventures is a great syndicate that, you know, is providing really the opportunity for individuals to be able to participate, to, you know, amalgamate their, you know, a capital to invest in companies. Swan was another personal one that we did that, you know, very excited about. I've been a Swan user for couple of years now. Stephen Cole is just everywhere. That guy's awesome. we joke that, you know, Stephen's already invested in something sometimes when we first take a look at it. So really, really have a good friendship with Stephen. I like that guy. So, and then what 10T is doing with kind of the growth capital, they're kind of operating in multiple spaces, but they are going to be providing growth capital for Bitcoin companies, which is absolutely needed. I mean, we only have a couple of companies that are really in that Series A, Series B round. So like that growth capital is going to be needed, and we look to help where we can.
Can you help the plebs out that are listening and kind of wondering about some of the terminology? Like, what do you mean by growth capital, seed A, seed B, series A, series B? You know, just because we have a varied listenership and some of the terminology between like the Euro plebs and America. So just walk us through it. So, you know, what's growth capital, for example?
So growth capital is typically after kind of a Series A, you're looking at Series B to see where a company may be raising $100 million and you need 20 to 50 million coming from, you know, one entity in itself that takes up half the round. So let's start at the beginning. So pre-seed, so when someone comes up with an idea and they want to bring on capital, they'll bring on typically in the US, they're the SAFE, the Simple Agreement for Future Equity, and that'll be what's called pre-seed money. So capital before a priced round, And then after they gain some traction and then more investors are willing to come on, they'll do a priced round, and that'll be your seed round is typically the first priced round, and they'll raise 5 million plus or minus a couple. And then after the seed, you go to your Series A, and that's where your larger kind of venture capital arms will start coming in and start riding, north of a million to several million and into that round, because they're typically going to be raising probably 10 to 20 million. And then
is there any way to kind of like price the company at this stage? I mean, certainly at the seed round, it's just like literally a gamble, right? Stick a finger in the air. There's no metrics. You cannot put a value on the company or its future earnings or prospects at all. It's just an idea at that point, but the founder needs a little bit of cash to get going.
Yeah, I think that there's a little bit more to it that I think you can isolate down into what is called multi-attribute decision-making, where, you can highlight 6 or 7 points that go into making a good decision, and how those points are weighted is dependent on what market or what decision you're trying to make. But where that company is sitting, you can kind of triangulate, what's the appropriate valuation. Kind of these are all fuzzy numbers, but trying to triangulate where that company should sit based on, the founder's history, their experience, the team that they have, how many, prospective users or how many users that they do have. So there's ways. And what's, I think is different, or what we're definitely seeing different in the Bitcoin realm, is that Bitcoiners typically build a product, or they have a minimal viable product before they start raising capital, or they have some type of experience. Whereas when we talk to founders that are coming from crypto land, like they're just raising 20 million on an idea. And that's just not the world that we're living in, with the kind of the double contrarian play. So, which I think is it's pretty good for us right now, in that, there isn't a lot of players chasing these deals, which is good and bad, I guess, depending on which side of the field you're looking at.
Good for me, because you're attracting the right investors. That's key, because you don't want to attract the exit guys who are just going to come in and jump all over your idea and push it where they want it to go so they can get their exit and, the seed round 1, 2, 3, 4, or 5.
Exactly. And that's what we, at the very beginning, what we were seeing is that as much as we were interviewing the companies, the companies were interviewing us to determine if they wanted us on their cap table. Mm-hmm. And I mean, that was very interesting, and just
power of Bitcoin.
It
flips the game board.
It does. And that, because with Bitcoiners, it's just, you have time preference. You're able to be low time preference. And I mean, that's actually what we named our funds, low time preference.
Love it. And there's also something else at play. If a founder comes to you, they've built the product, they've got the MVP going, they've got X amount of users, their churn rate is probably zero, because these people that are using their service, and Swan's a great example, you feel as though, as a Swan user, you probably feel as though you're friends with all of the other Swan users and the founders and the people that they bring in, whether it's Stefan or Andy or Brady or whoever else, like, there's going to be no churn.
there is a sense of camaraderie within a company, and you know, companies that are not just the Swan, but other companies that are operating, especially open source companies, you know, their brand is the moat. And when you have people, you know, buying into the brand because of what it stands for, like there's another connection on top of Bitcoin that, you know, people just enjoy and can enjoy each other and each other's company because they have this common belief in the future that they want to see, and they believe that, you know, this company helps to facilitate that. I mean, that's pretty exciting that, you know, in a world of, you know, lockdowns, you know, when you go to these Bitcoin meetups here in the US, I mean, they're so exciting to be at, and, you know, interacting with these large, diverse, you know, groups of individuals with, you know, their different life experiences or backgrounds, or even with our LPs, you know, being able to see their yearning for wanting some type of participation and part in the excitement is just palpable.
I was going to ask you about that. Generating a lead list, like how are you doing that? Where are you finding these companies?
I mean, we make a pretty significant push on, you know, a good presence everywhere. We think we've, you know, partnered with, two very, or all of them, very good individuals that, you know, had their own brands. And we were very fortunate enough that, you know, we were able to initially call them friends and then, you know, have them and where we talk on, you know, if not a daily basis and every other day basis. So I think with the best way to sum it up is we made good decisions, and in operating in an open system such as Bitcoin, that, you know, if you truly are who you say you are, you're going to get, you know, further recommendations to go here or go there or intros, because people just want to see this succeed. And, you know, we've tried to align ourselves as closely to an open system that Bitcoin is, the permissionless, you know, open system it is. And we operate that within the companies themselves, where we try to create an open system for companies to interact with each other so that they can build. And then we've created the 1031 tribe, which we call it the anti-fiat VC, where we have virtual events and then live events where we bring our LPs in, and they interact with us. They interact with the founders of companies that we bring in, and then they can interact with themselves. So we think that, you know, creating an opportunity for our LPs to be able to interact with founders in Bitcoin or other LPs or our team and create ideas, let spontaneity occur, will be a net positive for the space. And we want that same open permissionless system that Bitcoin is.
Would you mind just clearing up LPs, what that stands for?
Limited partners.
Right. Perfect. Are you following Bitcoiner Jobs on Twitter? That's a great lead generator to see which companies. I know they're very closely tied to Swan, so you got some competition.
Yeah, no. I remember when Corey started, I think it was Corey that started, or it was in one mm-hmm. of the chats, I think, with that. I mean, it's such a great, I mean, I've referred several people who have wanted to leave their fiat, you know, careers. Whether I had one guy that I'd been talking to about Bitcoin for several years, and he's a chiropractor, and he sold his practice and he wanted to start in Bitcoin. And I was like, well, look here. So I think it's going to be, I think that's great. Because it's that same initial thread that we had is, you know, mirrored, I think, in our limited partners, and, you know, just everyone that we interact is probably similar to you and why you started a podcast about Bitcoin.
Precisely. So I think probably what the listeners are probably going to want to know now is, okay, so a new company comes along, you see great potential there, you want to help them, you want to go into the seed round, you enjoy the company of the founder, you see their vision. Where does that money come from? Can other people back it with you? And is there a minimum amount that they have to, you know, put in?
Yeah, so we have two ways right now that we're doing that. One is we have our fund two that we have up and going, and we are bringing on partners or limited partners for that entity. And that's our main fund that we're going to be deploying capital out of. And then for opportunities that we hope to, or that we are carving out from deals that the fund does, that, you know, sometimes it's appropriate or best to also have a syndicate. We have the 1031 syndicate where individuals can join through AngelList, and they can do as minimum as $1,000 on AngelList into a specific deal that the fund is doing. And I mean, our goal is first to help push Bitcoin forward, and then to also bring along as many individuals as possible, because that will only compound over time. The people able to participate in being a part of Bitcoin. And I think once people, you know, have skin in the game, you know, it's more real to them. And, you know, even, you know, being able to put in $1,000 is real money. So we're very excited about both avenues that we have to be able to offer to companies to help to capitalize them.
Are you US only, or are you casting your eye across the pond for any of the Euro clubs that are building here?
Yeah, no, we have, I mean, if you look, so there's multiple foreign companies, some in France, in Marshall Islands, in Africa. So, I mean, there are companies that are specifically, you know, maybe focusing on a specific region in Latin America with the Lightning service providers. But, you know, we're, you know, agnostic to where a company is located. They can be anywhere. I mean, we're having a podcast or on your podcast that's, you know, 1500 miles or how many miles away?
We're apart.
Yeah. So I don't necessarily think that a company has to be in one geographical location. Now, I think if you're going to be doing direct mining, there's definitely places that you want to be and you don't want to be. But if you're, you know, we just want to back great Bitcoiners building great products to help, you know, bring the orange future that we want to see. That's it.
And what do you think excites you most about the next 2 to 5 years with what you've seen coming up down the pike in the Bitcoin space?
The utility of Bitcoin, the asset in Bitcoin, the monetary network, that, you know, you can create, you have a company that you no longer have to worry about having a global presence, because you automatically have a global presence. And you can create utility in ways that this, what we anticipate Bitcoin being the world reserve asset, in ways that, you know, can't happen today, such that, you know, you can create a new accounting method, or being able for invoicing, or for, you know, proof of accounts. Like, those are interesting. You have the ability for, you know, building a P2P intranet that, you know, Impervious is doing, and being able to, you know, immediately monetize that with sats over the Lightning network. And, or, I mean, with Unchained, I mean, Unchained's Caravan, which is their open source piece, I mean, is a global product. I mean, those are all exciting things that can't exist with the current financial monetary system that we have today. Like, they're just completely incompatible. So, I mean, what excites me is the utility, because it's the utility that is going to drive more value to the underlying asset. I mean, we're not going to get Bitcoin to 10 to 100 trillion with just the store of value narrative. There has to be value being created, you know, with creating the utility of the asset or the network to create the demand to drive up the price.
Yeah, mate, it's exciting times ahead. I don't need to tell you that. You're very much entrenched in it. You've extricated yourself from your fiat career to throw everything into to this Bitcoin realm. And yeah, it's just great to, it's been an incredible conversation. I really appreciate you giving up 2 hours. I've just seen the time of your time today to come on and talk about this, but I've got to hit you with a last question. I hope you come prepared. If you had one orange pill left to give to somebody, who would you give it to and why?
So I have thought about this, because you have it on every podcast. And I'm going to say my family. I think, you know, some of them, I believe they will over time, but, you know, they don't necessarily know the fundamental reasons why I think that this is important. And I think that that's Cynthia Loomis put out a great tweet. The Senator Cynthia Loomis put out a great tweet. You know, she came for NGU, but stayed for, you know, liberty. And, you know, in some small way, you know, trying to help humanity and help the future of humanity is a good thing to endeavor at. And I would like the immediate family to know that it's more than just making money.
I'm sure you're still the crazy guy who gave up his perfectly good medical career to throw it all away on some crazy crypto money that nobody understands.
Oh yes, no, my So my wife's an OBGYN, and this is referred to as my hobby.
Oh man. We'll get it there. We'll get it there. And to Senator Loomis's point, I should shield Knuts von Holm here because he made me think about this, and I've memed it a few times. Came for number go up, stayed for number go down.
Mm-hmm.
It's so beautiful. It's like everything there is about Bitcoin right there.
Yeah, I mean, it's just interesting. I don't know how we can envision what the future is going to hold, but I just see that when we get everyone coordinated and working together in some small way, that there really isn't anything that we won't be able to accomplish, in the future with that coordinated effort. That to me is something worth putting out as much effort as you can to migrate towards.
What our species was like made for. This is what we do.
I love it when Marty goes all cosmic, or when but it's just crazy, like how this happened, or how Bitcoin came to be. Like, why now? Why is it happening? It's just like you can really, bake on those ideas for quite a while. And then how fortunate and how lucky we are to be this early to it and get to see in real time the progression of Bitcoin permeating through our entire way of life, our entire way of life, not just the economic systems, but the change in mentality, or the way you individually think, and then as a society in a whole, how that will think moving forward. I think we'll be able to see it as it progresses, but you're just wondering, like, how long will that take for us to make the transition.
Keeps surprising me every year how quick it's moving. I think it's going to be a lot quicker than any of us imagine. And if you look at the opposing force, the opposing side, whatever you want to call it, the opposite team, Team Fiat, they're doing their best to snatch defeat from the jaws of victory. They're completely fucking it up. It's amazing to see.
Yeah, I think that the vast majority are just in this, state of, constant motion, and you don't have time to step back and raise your head up and look around and see what's happening, because you have to move so fast just to stay in place, just to keep what you currently have. I mean, that's the way in medicine with physicians, and I just think that's probably just pervasive everywhere, where whether you're a politician, a lawyer, anywhere, or just your regularly day job of stocking shelves, like you have to work so hard and move so fast just to try to keep up with what's happening, that you can't put it all together. And the system is so integrated now that how are you supposed to know what you know, small thing is happening along a supply chain, and that what was, you know, is affecting you. It's like the chaos theory, the butterfly flaps its wings and a tsunami happens across the world. I mean, that's how, I mean, we, our lives are so integrated with so many other lives that, you know, you just, it's poorly coordinated right now, but I think it's going to, the coordination is going to improve.
Has to. And decentralization is a huge part of this, and it's going to be the Bitcoiners that they're going to drive this forward. Well, Jonathan, it's been awesome, Rip, mate. It's been great to get to know you. I look forward to having more discussions. I really do. How can people come and find you and learn more about yourself and 1031? Where should we point them towards?
They can go to 1031.vc. Come there if you want to reach out. There's a way at the bottom of the website to reach out to us directly or get connected to our Angelus syndicate. Either way would be great. I mean, it's really awesome the being able to just discuss with kind of all walks of life. I mean, Bitcoiners come from everywhere. Mm-hmm. And being able to connect with them and, you know, share in this early secret that nobody else is paying attention to is just special.
Excellent. And I'll have your Twitter handle in the title of the show so people can come and find you on there as well.
Yeah, that's I'm at JKirkwoodMD on Twitter.
Excellent. All right, mate. Thank you so much, and look forward to catching up soon.
All right. Thanks.
Hey, guys. Thank you for tuning in, and thank you again, Jonathan, for coming on and sharing your life experience and that arc that you took us through over the last couple of years of your career in the hospitals. Fascinating stuff, really. And I'm just glad that, to be honest, that we've got you fully entrenched now in a Bitcoin world, because, you know, conviction like yours and minds like yours, that we need as many of these as possible on our side. And the fact that you are, you know, placing all of your time into helping the builders build is brilliant to see. Thank you again for coming on and everything you're doing. Guys, if you want to reach out, make sure you reach out to Jonathan and interact. Thank you, everybody, again. If you're streaming through one of the streaming apps, such as Fountain or Breeze, really appreciate that. Make sure you hit the show sponsors. All links are in the show notes. Get to the conference if you can. Hit that link in the show notes or use Bitten at checkout. That'll get you 10% off. Get yourself a hardware wallet. Stop it now. Just stop this show and go and order yourself a hardware wallet. Use the BitBox 02 Bitcoin Only Edition. And then stack with Relay, Swan, Bitcoin Reserve, or Coin Corner. It's all so easy. Let's go. Catch you on the next show.